A local author has written a book about World War II history.
And it's a lot of funny information, believe it or not, for a World War II history book.
Kent Whitaker's book is called Bullets and Bread. It contains war stories, but they're not stories about battles. They're stories about food.
Because one of the stories is here about a guy fishing off the front of a PT boat using a deck-mounted machine gun and or dynamite with a raft in a lagoon. So these are fun stories.
Kent Whitaker has written quite a few cookbooks and culinary books, including the Hometown Cookbook series. Whitaker joins us today to talk about his latest work, Bullets and Bread. Stay tuned. A Roundabout starts right now.
We'll get hoss and pfeffer and black pumpernickel for chow. We get hoss and pfeffer and black pumpernickel for chow. I blow my next month's pay for a slice of a Texas cow.
Hello and welcome to A Roundabout Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller, and Kent the Deck Chef Whitaker joins us today. He is a culinary author, and his latest book is called Bullets and Bread, the World War II story of feeding Americans at home and on the battlefield. Kent, welcome to A Roundabout.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's nice to be here.
What is so interesting about what soldiers were eating in World War II specifically? Because your book does cover a lot of military history, but the main focus is World War II.
Well, the book actually, when I first started this, my wife Al and I were in North Georgia, Dahlonega. Our son Mace was a cadet down there for the military and the Army. And we were at end of Frog Week and met some people that at a local shop, and it was Parents' Day kind of thing, and Mace said, "Hey, Dad, look, there's one of your barbecue books," because I did the barbecue books and the tailgate and NASCAR books. And
you found one of your books in a store.
Yeah, he points out the book, and he said, "Look, Dad, there's your barbecue book." And this guy said, "If that's your book, I want to get it and sign it." You know, so
right.
I said, "Cool." And it turns out he's an ex-military guy. He started talking about barbecuing in Kuwait with 50-gallon drums and things like that. Then another guy that was nearby, these are military town, military parents, you know, grandparents, stuff, walks over and goes, When I was in the Navy, we crossed the equator. We had this huge party on our ship. And then another guy, another Army guy came up and started talking about something. And I was thinking, this is an idea for a book. So I really started out collecting just military chow, best and worst chow stories. And when I made the proposal, the publisher, history publisher company that picked it up, said, you know, the greatest generation's really going away in a fast clip. And I started thinking about it. And the decision was to narrow the focus, to put out a story that's not a cookbook. It's a history of what these guys ate and loved about World War II. The working title is the best and worst of World War II chow line.
And your book, it's a mixture of those first-person accounts you've collected from soldiers, literally them in their own words, and just general historical research you've done. You uncovered some surprising facts. Like, I didn't realize PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, had a special can they made for soldiers in World War II.
Yeah, PBR really made use of this because the branding effort, you got to think about the consumer brands. They had to keep putting out stuff for the consumer. So the marketing effort on the consumer brands really took off in the States. How to better make foods, how to stretch ingredients, how to do stuff like this. Pabst Blue Ribbon and other beer companies that sent not only cans that just had beer over, but they also were requested by the government, the military, to figure out a way to do this where it wouldn't reflect light in dark, you know, blackout situations. So a lot of the cans going overseas were dipped in this kind of faint green tint, kind of like a coating that knocked a sheen off everything. You knew it was a camouflage can, but you could see through it enough to tell that you're drinking your Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Yeah.
You know, so they were able to get that brand message to the soldiers, and it gave the soldiers a feeling like, hey, I know I'm not at home, but if I was at home, I could be sitting out with my buddies fishing, drinking a PBR.
Right.
So, you know, they could see that they're not just drinking government beer. They're drinking a PBR, you know. It's pretty neat stuff.
And your book says that beer was really an important thing. The Army made it a point to have designated places for soldiers to get together and drink. Why was that important?
Well, it's a camaraderie thing. There's a, not saying everybody, you're in the Army or Navy now, go become an alcoholic or go get drunk, but a lot of places had the beer, and it wasn't just the American or the Allies. The Japanese had the same thing, beer gardens. And the same thing, you know, you could find a beer if it was necessary. You could probably always find coffee and cigarettes and things like that. So there was a big effort put on making sure that, for the most part, that guys had what they needed, had what they wanted, especially around Thanksgiving, Christmas. A huge effort was put out to get these guys special meals, you know.
And if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Kent Whitaker. His book is Bullets and Bread, the World War II story of feeding Americans at home and on the battlefield. One of the surprising things in the book is, you know, you think of military cuisine, MREs, but yeah, your book goes way beyond that. And it turns out some military chow was actually really, really good. Particularly, it seems like soldiers who were on battleships got to eat pretty well.
Oh, yeah. There's a Bill Tunnel invited me down to the USS Alabama in Mobile, Alabama, when I was working, when I first started working on this. And I remember going down there as a kid and taking tours, but it never really dawned on me. But one thing that really stuck in my head was I remember there being an ice cream stand on this battleship.
So an ice cream stand on a battleship.
Yeah,
wow.
And a lot of the aircraft carriers, and that's not too uncommon today, but back in the day, you know, they had refrigeration.
Yeah.
They had the capability to make these things. Whereas smaller boats, PT boats, they couldn't really do something like that, you know. But this battleship, the USS Alabama, had what they called a G-Dunk, and it was an ice cream stand. You could walk in. It was just like a town malt shop, just like a small town malt shop. It had snacks, ice cream, candy bars, coffee, things like that. And that's just cool to me.
Reading your book, it made me very oddly nostalgic for the World War II era in terms of food. And of course, I wasn't actually alive back then, so
yeah,
it was pretty weird feeling nostalgic. But when I thought about it, I realized it wasn't exactly the food itself. It's more just, I think, what people were going through back then, in the sense of food became scarce, both for people at home and the soldiers out there. And it seems like food was just more important at that time. It wasn't like it is now, where you just grab fast food and you don't even think about it.
The rationing really kicked in the United States and put a focus on the need and what need was and what want was, I think, for food to a consumer level. The Victory Gardens and things like that popped up as a way to feed small groups of individuals, small community groups, while not taking that product out of the production chain that went to the commercial and the war effort. So if you've got a whole bunch of people doing their own lettuce and their turnips and their carrots and making all their own vegetables, all of the commercially produced vegetables can be funneled into the war effort.
And it's something people are really talking about today, the idea of local food and community gardens and things like that. But of course, we don't have a war forcing us to do it, so we just generally don't.
It went kind of two roads. In the book, when I was working on Bullets and Bread, I wasn't really aware of the effort. It started as a memory book for World War II soldiers. And then the question was, well, what was a D-bar? Then, you know, what was the air ration? What was the Siemens ration? Well, then somebody, we laid down this group of questions. What did they eat on a battleship? What did they eat in a plane? What did they eat in a PT boat? What did they eat in a, how did you feed all these guys? Then the question was, well, did the Axis governments do it different? Did they do it the same? Oh, wait, Jimmy Stewart was in the Army. So all these questions, you know, I don't want anybody to pick this book and think it's just a long history book. It's really kind of blurb information. Jimmy Stewart like this, you know, a Hollywood star like this. Yes, the Queen Mother liked hot sauce. You know, the president enjoyed these things. And it's a lot of funny information, believe it or not, for a World War II history book. So what really occurred to me was that people knew the story of plants going over and making battleships and planes and tanks and bullets and helmets and boots.
Yes.
The same effort, the same kind of line of progression took place in food production with the nationalization of the food, the production efforts, packaging, shipping, storage, nutrition, all of these things parallel to making tanks happened on the food side. And, you know, that's something I really didn't think of. Back then, cities were local, 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 local.
Yeah.
Now it was, oh, we're making all this stuff here, but we have to get it to California on a ship, or we got to get it to the East Coast. Now we got to make sure it's produced right, that it's safe, that it's packed, that it's stored, that it's refrigerated, and we have to have transportation. We need trains. So the whole thing was grow it at home and stay off the trains. That's because they wanted to get soldiers and materials to the different ports and move them around the country. So that effort that took place to supply the guys with tanks and bullets, also on the culinary side, took place to make sure everybody was fed.
And we're running out of time, but very quickly, what other books have you written? I know you've written quite a few of culinary kind of books.
Yeah, first one was Smoke in the Mountains, all about Appalachian barbecue. Checkered Flag Cooking, Tailgating NASCAR and ARCA Racing, and then there's the State by State Cookbook series, which has Tennessee Hometown Cookbook, Georgia Hometown Cookbook, Texas Hometown Cookbook, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, finished Alaska, starting on West Virginia. Then there is a picture book for, well, a picture image history book for the USS Alabama. And then there's Big Mo's Tennis Ball Hunt and Why Are the Mountain Smokies, which are my two kids' books. And then there's an ebook I wrote about me jumping off an Olympic-sized diving board, which is called The Big Belly Flop.
Wow. So you're a pretty prolific guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, I met an author the other day, and we started talking about using the initial. So if you see something by M.K. Whitaker shortly, that might be me too.
And your latest book is Bullets and Bread, the World War II story of feeding Americans at home and on the battlefield. If you have a World War II soldier in your family, I think this is the kind of thing that soldier would be interested in reading, or just somebody who lived through the war.
Any kind of history buff, if you like the History Channel, Discovery Channel, Destination America, Food Network, and anything like that, a good story, this is your kind of book. I really enjoyed it. And don't think about horrible war stories. Think about Cary Grant, Operation Petticoat, having a picnic on top of their submarine, because one of the stories is here about a guy fishing off the front of a PT boat using a deck-mounted machine gun and or dynamite with a raft in a lagoon. So these are fun stories.
Kent Whitaker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.